this is 2018 opportunities in the late cycle bull. In this presentation, the team will provide an analysis of the global investment environment, including economic and financial conditions, geopolitics, technological and social developments, and market dynamics. The team will also highlight specific significant trends and developments both in the markets and in industries they find attractive and in those they believe investors should avoid. On the call, we have Monty Gill, Chief Investment Officer, Anthony Danaher, President, Rudy Von Oble, Senior Research Analyst, and I am Tim Sharada, Executive Vice President. I'll give everyone a moment to read the disclaimer. Please note, the conference call is designed to help investors with their global macro investment approach. We will not be able to answer or comment on questions pertaining to specific companies that we have not recommended. In addition, as an SEC registered investment advisor, we may not be able to comment on specific stocks and other investment vehicles due to conflicts of interest, insider information, and or regulatory issues. We thank you for participating in this conference call, and we look forward to helping you reach your investment goals. The call will be approximately 1 hour in duration, a 30-minute presentation, followed by a 30-minute Q&A. Questions can be submitted via text box during the presentation and during the Q&A session. We will try to answer all questions. However, due to possible time constraints, we may not be able to answer all questions. We will try to incorporate any questions we have not answered in future commentaries, or you can reach us on our telephone. I would like to introduce Monty Gill, Chief Investment Officer.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the call. First slide we have is U.S. and global corporate profit growth momentum is very strong and will continue through the end of this year and possibly much longer. As a result of that, after a strong January and tumultuous February, can investors expect further bullish performance from stocks? Our answer is a one-word answer, and the answer is yes. Page number 8, point number 2. Tax cuts in the U.S. and other countries will boost growth. Benefits will begin to appear in year 2 of a new tax regime and continue to appear over the following 3 or 4 years. Inflation and interest rates are rising. This will create sloppy, volatile declines followed by rallies to new highs as fear waxes and wanes, are gradually starting and then dissipating. We saw one of those yesterday afternoon. We saw one of those in January, and they're all followed by big rallies. Page number 10, let knowledge be your guide rather than fear. The current bull market has been a long one historically, but bull markets do not die of old age. They are killed by recessions, and recessions are caused by deterioration in financial and economic fundamentals. Basically, in this cycle, by it, a failure of the credit system, could be the banking system like it was in 2007 and 8, or it could be the credit system, which could be caused by the Federal Reserve or others raising interest rates around the world too high. Currently, interest rates are rising, but they are well below the rate of inflation for short-term rates, and they are well below the rate of return on invested capital for businesses. Therefore, businesses have an incentive to borrow at this stage of the cycle, not to pay back, and therefore credit is expanding and the market will go higher. Now I'd like to turn it over to Rudy Von Oble on page 11. Rudy?
Hi, everybody. The slides that follow are basically an update to the slides that we had in our last conference call back in October. And we called this set the Recession Watcher's Guide to the Critical Variables. So these are some of the most important factors that we watch for signs of a turn in the credit cycle, for the first warning signs of a recession on the horizon. So if you go to slide 12, the first factor that we look at, and one of the most important that you've probably heard a lot about in financial media, if you follow financial media, is the yield curve, which is basically the spread between short-term interest rates and long-term interest rates. And there are a few different ways you can look at that. Some people look at the difference between 6-month treasury yields and 10-year, or between 2-year and 10-year. In the graph that follows, we'll show 6-month versus 10-year. But our basic point is that the yield curve is not close to being inverted. And this is an event that occurs prior to the onset of every recession, and very typically prior to a bull market peak that precedes the onset of that recession. An inversion just means that short-term rates are above long-term rates. So if we, in the slide 13, which you're looking at now, there's a 50-plus year history of the yield curve in the United States and U.S. recessions, which are the sort of tan bands vertically across that graph. And the blue line just represents the spread between short-term rates and long-term rates. So when that dips down below zero, that's a warning sign that the credit cycle is about to shut down and a recession is going to be in the offing, typically after some lag. So if you look at the right-hand side of that chart, you can see that we're not yet in danger territory in that regard. If you turn to slide 14, you would expect, or the thinking might be, that as the yield curve narrows, as that spread narrows, as the curve flattens, it would be bearish. But in fact, that's not the case. It's actually bullish. When that spread first narrows to 100 basis points or 1%, it's a bullish event in history. That happened in June 2017. So here's a little chart showing recessions from 1969 to the Great Recession in 2008. That's identifying what recession we're talking about. And then the next column, if you could go back to 14, that'd be great. Yeah, the next column shows you how much time elapsed between when the spread narrowed to that 100 basis points and the market peak. So on average, for all of those incidents of recession, there's about a 20-month lag between when the yield curve narrowed and when the market ultimately peaked. And during those 20 months, on average, although there's a lot of variability in there, obviously, on average, the market returned a little under 29%, sometimes much more, sometimes a little less. So that narrowing is actually quite a bullish event. The next critical variable that we look at, we're fond of saying around here that corporate profits are the mother's milk of stock prices. So we like to see good momentum in corporate profit growth. So what you're looking at here in this chart, the white line shows you the behavior of the S&P 500 index. The green and purple lines, should be a red line really, basically show you the momentum of corporate profit growth. When that green line pops below the purple line, that means that corporate profit growth is radically decelerating, drastically decelerating. So you can see we had a kind of problematic period there in 2015 and 2016, where dollar strength and a very steep decline in the oil price kind of messed things up in terms of corporate profits, and then it took off again, and the market took off again with it. So we do not see any signs right now that corporate profit growth momentum is slowing down. Another critical variable we look at is business sentiment and consumer sentiment, and we all know, we've said many times that after the election of the current administration, small business optimism spiked at the most rapid rate basically since the Reagan administration. And it has continued to rise, and it's making new recent highs again. And consumer sentiment is also positive and trending up. So small businesses, which are the engines of job growth and the engines of productivity growth in the United States, small businesses are feeling good about the world, and consumers are feeling good about the world too. The fourth variable that we look at is the global growth picture. And there's also been a lot of talk in financial media for the past while about a coordinated uptick in global growth, where the current economic expansion around the world is hitting its stride. And if we go to the next slide, this graph shows you basically the dark green lines show you members of the OECD. That's the world's big economies. The dark green shows you members of the OECD where growth is accelerating. The light green shows you where growth is at least positive, if not accelerating, and the red shows you countries that are in recession. So right now, we've actually got everybody in the OECD in expansion and a lot of them accelerating. And this is relatively rare. It happens during late stages of economic expansions, and it's happening now. So that's a very positive backdrop. Now I'm going to pass the phone to Tony Danaher to discuss some of the other factors, inflation and interest rates.
Good morning, everybody. Well, all of that economic growth that Rudy was just discussing does have effects, and I don't necessarily want to call them consequences, but they're effects, and one of them is inflation. And, you know, it's a critical variable that underlies asset prices and investment flows. U.S. inflation and inflation expectations have accelerated, although they're still quite low by historical standards. And the relationship inflation has with assets is that at some point you get concerns about stock valuations, higher rates are an effect of higher inflation, and at some level those higher rates start to compete with stocks. But what we're seeing right now, if you flip to the next slide, is inflation expectations are still anchored at historically low levels, about 2.1%, although that's up significantly from the summer of 2016 when it was 1.5% to 1.75%. This chart here is an index of inflation-protected treasury securities, and it just gives an idea as to what people's expectations for inflation are. So at 2.1%, it's not alarming, but it is higher than it was. And the trajectory, the steepness of that curve is how you determine where you would like to be investing or how much you want to pull back your exposure to risk assets. It's inflation expectations and its corresponding relationship with interest rates is the reason we got that spastic activity in the very beginning of February, with the relationships and the computers getting all concerned about the steepness of the 10-year treasury. Flipping to slide 21, the next critical variable is this amount of stress in the system. And the banking system stress that we went through in 2007, 2008, 2009 is not anywhere in the cards as we're looking at it right now. The banking system is quite healthy. The levels are low, as you'll see from the next chart. And this is a combination of different indicators, high yield spreads, access to capital, bank capital. Banks did a very good job in the U.S. at least of recapitalizing themselves from 2009 to 2012. And it's really made the system quite healthy. So as you can see on this chart, this is financial stress index is quite low. And so as you get disruptions and volatility in the market, you might see this pick up, but still it has nothing at a -0.8 reading. It's still a long way from where we were in early 2009 when we were up at positive 2.5. Flipping to slide 23. The seventh critical variable, and this is something we watch every day here along with other, but the U.S. dollar. And the U.S. dollar is in a small rally right now. It's been in a decline, a downtrend for a little over a year after a huge upswing from the middle of 2014 to early 2016. And it's erasing some of those gains slowly. When the dollar downtrend resumes, it's going to be beneficial for U.S. multinationals and for emerging market shares. You can't stress how important it is to watch the dollar. Its movements kind of dictate the opportunity set, whether you want to invest in the U.S. or international, importers versus exporters, consumer commodity, growth stocks versus other stocks. So we just watch this dollar. And if you go to slide 24, you can see that big swing up that started in the summer of 2014. For about a year and a half, it made investing a challenge for U.S. investors. The strong dollar undermined commodity companies. It undermined exporters, and corporate profits, as Rudy was showing in the a few charts ago, had that dip. It's a strong dollar is just not good for U.S. corporate profits. And so what we see right now for a little over a year is a declining dollar, and this is very beneficial. Slipping to slide 25, a primary risk, and we talked about it a couple slides ago, is inflation. If inflation expectations accelerate, and if inflation looks like it's going to be going up to 5%, then you have a dramatic shift in how capital should be allocated. There's a very low risk that we think this is going to occur. However, if it does happen, gold, copper, oil, and other commodities are going to outperform. The Fed will push up interest rates, and that's going to have a very disastrous effect on bonds and a not very helpful effect on many stocks. If this happens, again, it's a low probability. Gold, the commodities, will be great places to invest. Cash earning very little interest rates will be better than bonds. I want to talk a little bit about gold. Gold is in a trading range right now, and until the computers and institutional investors decide to start allocating to it, there just isn't a big pull to get it out of its trading range. There's no reason to believe that gold isn't going to retain its thousands of year history as a role of a store of value, wealth preservation tool, or inflation hedge. It will. But it's just right now, it's just not among the favorite asset classes by the computers and all the institutional money managers. And it probably needs a higher tick up in inflation to really get gold out of this trading range. It's attractive, and it probably could go higher as inflation levels and expectations tick up. But for gold to really start a new bull market, you need some concerns about the policymakers, concerns about government, or much faster rising inflation than we have right now. So on slide 26, just want to reiterate the basic message is where we are right now. It's a late stage bull market, but there is money to be made. There's a recession and a bear market in our future. They're coming, but they're not imminent. Watch the data, watch the signals. The market will tell you when it's coming. The market is a discounting mechanism, so you can't necessarily wait till CPI hits a high number. You're going to have already seen it in assets. So that's what we're doing in here, just watching all these signals, looking for this. In the late stages of a bull market, it's when many of the gains are made. You get the blow-off stage, we like to call it. So we want to be in, but we want to be alert, watching the signals. I'd like to turn the call back to Monty for a moment to talk about politics, because it's always on everybody's mind.
Hi, I'm not really going to talk about politics, but I am going to talk about the positives of the current economic situation. Tax cuts were passed ahead of the expected timeline, gave the market a big jolt upward in January, and it was followed by a substantial correction in early February. The current administration continues to make incremental regulatory changes, and such changes depend on bureaucratic fiat rather than congressional action. So no major political changes are taking place, but the current administration believes in cutting red tape for business and believes in having lower income taxes for both corporates and for individuals. And as a result, consumer spending will grow as the individuals have more money in their paycheck. And capital spending will grow as corporations have incentives to form capital. This will increase productivity and make the economy better, in our view, throughout 2018 and 19. Your first winning decision will be to stay in the market rather than to be scared out by premature fears of a bear market. We're good at identifying bear markets in advance, which has been one of our main skills over the last 45 years. But please be aware that there is a time to be in. This is such a time. Now comes the hard part, identifying the best opportunities. In the U.S., our favorite themes are primarily among big cap growth stocks. Until tax reform and infrastructure spending materialize, there's a lag between the time the tax law is passed and the time the new factory can be finished. There's a lag between the time the incentives to build, buy the new equipment take place and the new equipment is installed in the factory and producing products. We think U.S. big cap growth stocks will continue to attract investment dollars from this country and from Europe and from Japan and from the emerging world. Corrections in the stock market are likely given the positive fundamental backdrop. Do not be alarmed, but rather use these dips as a buying opportunity. This is, we're talking about stocks here, and the sectors we currently favor are on slide 30. Industrial equipment exporters. That's because a weak dollar and tax incentives can create demand for our industrial products to be shipped across the world. Video games. It's a very fast-growing sector of our economy, dominated by Korean, Japanese, and American companies, all of which have excellent software and programming. And this is an area where the cost of new video games is low, the marketing is high, and the acceptance is high. Some violent video games are falling out of favor, but video games as a whole, especially the more healthy family-oriented ones, are growing very rapidly. A third area of great opportunity is artificial intelligence, big data, and the Internet of Things. This is mainly a software investment area, but some equipment and hardware is necessary for this. These words may not ring to you all. So let's just say artificial intelligence will create self-driving cars. It will create all kinds of consumer products. It will cause your dealing with banks and financial institutions to change. It will allow you to transact business more easily on an international level. It will allow you to save money on your credit cards. The cost of credit cards is going to fall due to artificial intelligence. Big data involves the cloud and storage of data in the cloud, where there are many big companies competing in that area. And the Internet of Things is identifying all objects and putting them in the same system so they can be communicated to and communicated about. Regional banks and financial services benefit by higher interest rates. This is good for banks. They've had very low profit margins in recent years, especially regional banks, which are not the big banks. They don't do the things the big banks do. They mainly make loans to local businesses in their areas. And as interest rates rise, they do much better. Financial services will do better as people start to use credit cards and PayPal and Google Pay and Apple Pay and these kind of services more and more. Demand for all of these products will continue and grow. Copper and gold will benefit as long as the dollar continues to fall. Currently having a short-term rally. If it continues to fall, as many technicians believe it will, that will do good things for copper and gold. Copper will be used to reinvigorate the technology and the infrastructure in India and China, where air conditioning and all kinds of new activities are taking place using rewiring the existing system and wiring a new system. Where people have not had good cooling and heating services in many of these countries. 1.3 billion Indians, 1.3 billion Chinese, they're going into the Gobi Desert, and much of India is over 110 degrees much of the year. So there's huge demand for air conditioning. If that air conditioning does occur, as a result of improving economic status in India and China, demand for copper could skyrocket. Emerging markets, our favorites are China, South Korea, Vietnam, Taiwan, India, and Chile for various reasons. China, South Korea, Vietnam, and Taiwan for very rapid growth and reasonable prices. India for a reindustrialization and a new management of the country last few years, which has taken it from socialist focus to growth focus, and Chile because of a change in government and raw material availability. And now I'll turn it back to Tony. Tony?
just want to elaborate in slide 31 and some of the following slides about the emerging market opportunity. Many of the emerging markets lagged the U.S. bull market for years, and so their bull market is younger. Some of the best opportunities we see are in emerging markets, depending on what the dollar does. Tech-heavy exporters, as Moni mentioned, Latin American copper and gold producers, these could double before this this bull stock market is over. If you go to slide 32, you can see an illustration of just how much the emerging markets have lagged in terms of performance compared to the S&P. It's just a much younger bull market. And this is further being reinforced, if you go to slide 33, by what's happening to profits. Emerging market corporate earnings, these are estimates, and they're finally turning up. After several years of estimates being too high and having to be downgraded, again and again and again, you see the last 2 years, earnings estimates are actually being revised upward. And this is just very good for values. The emerging market stocks in general sell at much lower valuations on a PE basis than U.S. stocks and have wonderful growth characteristics, depending on where they are, what their product or service is. So on slide 34, 2009 to 2011, these markets languished, when you saw their profits just not coming through, and they only started their bull market in 2016. And when you look at back at all of their past bull markets, they usually range, they average over 4 years and go up 270% over that time period. This new market is less than 2 years old, and it's only had about a 74% return. So we see a lot more potential upside here. But again, we are watching closely the dollar, because your emerging market performance will be hurt or helped by the direction of the dollar, being dollar-based investors. Just to reiterate on slide 35, what some of our favorites are: China, Taiwan, Vietnam, India, South Korea, and Chile all have different characteristics. We particularly like the Chinese internet technology stocks. At this juncture, there's just a lot of change taking place, a lot of disruption, a lot of innovation, and many of the new social uses for the internet with respect to payments and social media are really gaining a foothold in China and spreading from Asia outward. If inflation picks up and the dollar is lower, then you'll see a much better opportunity for some of the commodity-related emerging market countries. But again, that does require a lower dollar to make those more attractive than some of these other faster growing markets. And, with the good, there are areas that we see being problematic. And bond investors at this point, slipping this slide 36, should be very cautious here. Shorten your maturities. The timing is not clear. Interest rates have been going down since 1982. They bottomed over the past 3 years and look like they're heading higher. It seems a certainty that many interest rates have to head higher. In Europe, interest rates were largely negative just a year and a half ago, and so we don't see this very low interest rate environment as sustainable. So as you have rising interest rates, you have a headwind on your bond portfolios. So we find bond portfolios to be very unattractive. If you have to own bonds, shorten your maturities. If you don't have to own bonds, cash in a rising interest rate environment will be picking up in yield is a better option. Bond funds are even more problematic. Bond funds have captured a lot of capital over this last 10 years with people desperate for yield. And bond funds just are not very good in a rising interest rate environment and could perform much worse than their underlying bonds just because of the way they're constructed and the illiquidity of those underlying instruments. So just want bond investors to be cautious, trim your bond holdings or shorten maturities if you're able to. I'm going to turn it back to Rudy and Tim, who have some comments on the digital currency space.
Thanks, Tony. There's a fun image for you.
I had to give you some piece of the crypto memes that have floated by me over the past couple of months. And this one expresses what any of you who have been watching the cryptocurrency space know. December was an extremely exciting time. January, the thrill began to go away. And in February, things really kind of hit a bottom. Looking at slide 38, Bitcoin got close to or over $19,000 and then crashed as low as 6, and now it's rallied back to almost 12 again. So, and with most of the other cryptocurrencies following suit. So anybody who jumped into the cryptocurrency game in November or December got a rapid education in how volatile and crazy these markets are. We continue to believe that digital currencies are here to stay in the long term. But for now, this level of volatility, which comes from a variety of different sources, means that basically these things are for trading and for speculation and not yet ready for investment prime time. Going to slide 39, here are some of the risks that we see after looking at this space for a year or more. Top of the list is market manipulation. So a lot of the, I don't want to say propaganda, but a lot of the talk around from cryptocurrency enthusiasts has been that this is a financial space which is not subject to the manipulation of governments and which is not subject to the overreach of regulators. And while we can see that point, there are also negatives there. And some of the shenanigans that may be going on in cryptocurrency markets are not dissimilar to things that used to happen in stock markets in the developed world before they got well regulated. So one issue in particular for Bitcoin in terms of market manipulation is when you get down into the guts of how various exchanges operate and what their banking relationships are. One very significant exchange uses a cryptocurrency which is allegedly pegged to the US dollar called Tether. And supposedly this institution has one US dollar in reserve for every Tether that it creates to facilitate transactions among exchanges. The only problem is that nobody knows who their bank is and it's never been audited. And they've sort of steadfastly refused to provide a real audit. And so the suspicion has been growing that, in fact, Tether is not backed one-to-one, which means ultimately that the Bitcoin price in December may have been getting juiced by non-existent U.S. dollars that were created out of thin air by some of these institutions. So in the wild west of cryptocurrencies, this kind of stuff is going to be able to go on until regulators get a little bit more aggressive. And of course, what everyone hopes for is a sweet spot where the regulators are aggressive enough to root out this kind of ill dealing, but not so aggressive that they crush the space. And there was some testimony in Congress recently that was very constructive with SEC and CFTC officials there that gave a pretty friendly view and helped. That was part of what helped Bitcoin come back from its decline. Another issue for us is that we see is technological issues around scaling. Scaling means you know, when you look at a financial transaction network, for example, the global credit card networks, those are handling a number of transactions, hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands of times more volume than the Bitcoin network is handling now. And even at current transaction levels of transaction, the Bitcoin network is very congested and it's very expensive. The same is true for Ether. So if you look at what it would take for various cryptocurrencies actually to get up to the level where they could rival some of these existing exchange systems like Visa and MasterCard, there's going to be some technological changes that need to come in. into play. And there are people working on these things, but nobody quite knows what the ramifications of those are going to be. For a comment on privacy stuff, I'm going to pass the phone to Tim.
I just wanted to add to the scaling issue. We know that there are some broadcast issues, and everyone in the world is sharing essentially a single connection, and it can get very congested. So there are some scalability initiatives now, such as Lightning Network, State Channels, Plasma, Sidechain, and Sharding, and crypto enthusiasts are optimistic as it continues to be developed and deployed. We also want to warn our readers and our subscribers of fake exchanges and Ponzi schemes. So we've had some of our clients actually reach out to us, and they've received emails in regards to a algorithm or a trading platform that guarantees X percent. We would caution our subscribers and readers to take that with a grain of salt. There are privacy issues in terms of the cryptocurrency and also regulatory issues. In terms of regulatory issues, governments involved with regulation on various different exchanges and ICOs. All of these must be resolved before digital assets become a legitimate investment vehicle. Going to the next slide, digital assets will survive. Whether any particular currently existing cryptocurrency survives, even Bitcoin, is an open question, and depends on the developing technology and regulatory environment. So we are watching this space very, very closely and seeing if there's any opportunities as these things unfold. I would like to open this up to the Q&A session. We have received a few questions here, and
We got one question. This is Tony. We got one question earlier by email, and it has to do with just yuan-based, the Chinese currency-based oil benchmarking could start early or in late March, just in the next couple of months. And, you know, what's that going to mean to the crude price? What does it mean for global trade? You know, there have been concerns for decades about the Chinese currency taking over as a world reserve currency. And Monty has just been telling people for decades that until they open up their banking system, it's just not probable. It's just not likely. And when you get down to the oil trade, you know, one of the developments that's happened just in the last few years is that the U.S. is on a path to be the world's largest, you know, liquids, petroleum, and finished products producer. So while that global oil trade is still very important, it's becoming less and less important each year. So we just don't necessarily see it as having the big impact that some have feared, and some like to build a great amount of fear that the Chinese currency is going to take over for the U.S. dollar. It's just not in the cards in the near future. I don't know if Monty has anything he wants to add.
Hi. These kind of transactions in local currencies to do trading in commodities have been going on for hundreds of years. They've never stopped. The only thing that's changed is the publicity around them has been increased. This was going on in the 70s. It was going on in the 60s when I began investing. It has been going on for hundreds of years. There's nothing new here. It's just that the media decided to highlight it. Not an important issue. Now to the next question.
Just a question about the interest rate environment. You know, it's changed. What is the interest rate environment, Tim? If you go back to that question, pardon me. That had to do just with a change in the interest rate environment, and we agree. We've gone from a declining interest rate, you know, scenario to a rising interest rate scenario, and it does change the whole investment outlook. It will change capital flows. New opportunities are created by rising rates. Monty mentioned banks and financials are one area. And given the reason for the rising rates, if it's inflationary, or if it's inflation that's driving interest rates higher, then it opens up other areas, commodities, for investment. So yes, we see a change in the investment or the interest rate picture, and we're looking at the different opportunities to invest because of it. Lower rates were nice. They are nice. We don't want rates to go up too fast because they do have a negative effect on economic growth. But if interest rates are being driven up by other variables, those variables will create new opportunities. Go ahead, Monty.
I'd just like to take the next question, which is, what about Europe for an investment opportunity? Our view on Europe has been jaundiced for some time. We're not enthusiastic about Europe for various reasons. One is the economic and political framework. A second is interest rates, which are low in Europe, and they have been doing quantitative easing. It will probably stop happening sometime later this year. But the most important reason ties into the previous question, interest rates. Europe has had absurdly low interest rates, even negative interest rates, to try and incentivize inflation to come back because they were in a deflationary crisis. They were in a deflationary crisis because they never restructured and recapitalized their banking system to the degree that they should have. That remains an ongoing problem in Europe. And when the next world banking crisis takes place, our bets are that it probably happens either in Europe or in China. Definitely probably not in the United States or other parts of the world, because the banking system in Europe is quite weak. Therefore, we're not enthusiastic about European stocks. The fact that the dollar has been falling in recent months is also bad for European exporters. And after rallying for 6 years, the dollar has begun to decline, and as a result of that, Europe's day in the sun is over. We would not be investing in Europe at all. Next question.
Thanks, Monty. We had a question, a lengthy question here, which I'll summarize, which was basically asking about the prospects of some of our really big growth tech growth companies in terms of antitrust, namely the Googles and the Amazons and the Facebooks. Will they be facing antitrust activity from the government? And there's been noise about this for some time. That noise got very loud as the you know, possible use of U.S. social media platforms by hostile powers during the past election came to light, and all that sort of thing. And of course, in Europe, European regulators who are a little bit more activist about this kind of stuff, they've been cracking down and fining some of these big tech operators for some time. Overarchingly, the answer to this question, will these companies face antitrust regulation? Will they face potentially even being broken up into pieces at some point down the road? The answer to that is probably yes. Probably they will. However, it's probably not imminent. And the central reason for that is that in this country, the politicians who would be responsible for doing that are beholden to a large group of people called voters who are mostly consumers. And I can speak anecdotally about my own experience and the experience of many of my friends. Whenever, for example, I hear friends discussing Amazon and discussing Amazon's, you know, some people complain about Amazon's business practices in various ways, but everybody uses Prime because everybody likes the convenience. And the fact is that all of these large companies are very beneficial for consumers, and those consumers will make their opinions known to their politicians. And also, they're very intelligent operators. When we look at Facebook's response to some of the allegations that have been made and some of the things that have come out recently, their response was pretty robust, and even to the point where it was caused volatility in their stock price and caused some shareholders to reconsider whether they wanted to own the company, whether their profits would be challenged as a result of these actions they were taking. So these are intelligent operators, obviously, and while regulation is probably out there somewhere, it's probably not in the immediate future. Yes, and I'm going to pass
one last point on this issue. Europe is going to attack all of these companies. There's no question about that. They've already attacked them. They will continue to attack them. The reason is very simple. Antitrust in Europe is based on competitive ability of the European companies to compete with the companies that are being criticized by the antitrust authorities. Within Europe, the whole thing that determines whether you are an antitrust problem is whether you are destroying your competition. Clearly, within Europe, Google, Facebook, Amazon, and others are wreaking havoc on their competition. So we can expect this regulation to grow, increase, and be more vehement in Europe. In the United States, as Rudy pointed out, there's a completely different standard for what antitrust is. Antitrust in the United States is about whether it hurts the consumer, not whether it hurts the competitor. Therefore, lower prices and consumer benefits will have kept these companies, which have become gigantic and probably unfairly treated their competitors in many ways, popular with the authorities. In addition to that, the Trump administration is an administration which does not believe in antitrust as much as some previous administrations have. Therefore, the administration itself is not oriented towards antitrust, especially in the case where the consumer is not being hurt. Should it change and the consumer could be proved to be being hurt, should prices start to rise on Amazon instead of fall, people be hurt in other ways, even emotionally or psychologically or physically, by these portals, then you would see big legislation against them in the United States. Until that case, we think most of the angry legislation will be from abroad. Tim handed me another question that came in over the computer. Please discuss how a higher U.S. dollar makes investing in India and China less favorable or more expensive. Do their growth rates offset the strength or weakness of the U.S. dollar? There's really two things you have to look at when investing in any foreign country, including Europe, Asia, China, India. It is, one, the currency, and two, the economic impact of the currency on growth in that country. In India, it's a closed economy. Exports are not a big part of their business. They're mainly a domestic economy. Their currency rises and falls versus the dollar. And as a foreign investor, you have to determine whether the Indian rupee will rise or fall versus the dollar. If the rupee is going up versus the dollar, since activity in the country and economic growth is domestic almost entirely, very little exports to the United States or to Europe, the key thing is to determine, will you lose money on the currency as a dollar-based investor when the stock market rises enough to make the stock market rise disappear? That's the big question. We think the Indian rupee will gradually decline in value versus the U.S. dollar, no matter what the U.S. dollar does, but we think Indian profits will grow more rapidly. So we're favorable on India. Within China, it's an industry-by-industry situation. We like some industries in China. We dislike others. We dislike all of the state-owned enterprises. We dislike banking in China, where there's many manipulative products being sold to people. There's an overexpansion of the credit cycle within China, which is unhealthy. On the other hand, because of Chinese style of functioning, where they don't mind big corporations that are friendly to the government, people like Alibaba, Tencent, Baidu, and others have been able to grow at incredibly rapid rates under the protection of the government. And as long as they do not go out of favor with the government, you won't be able to see shrinkage in growth in those big companies in China. So we're bullish on those and would use declining prices to buy them. Next question.
Here's your question. Just for the next year, this is an interesting question because it's what the market is grappling with in this volatile period. Is the critical variable the power of the economic growth? Is that greater than the factor of rising interest rates and how its effect on the market? So you have strong economic growth or rising interest rates. You know what seem to be positives and negatives, push pull on the investment environment. Well, at some point, people are going to start seeing or discounting this strong economic data that we have may be coming to an end. And if at that time the inflation data and interest rates are still going up, you'll start to hear that word that was so common back in the 70s, stagflation. But we're just not there yet. The global economy is strong. Corporate profits are strong, especially after this this tax package that was just passed. So what we're seeing is strong economic growth leading to corporate profits, and that is for the time being overwhelming the concerns about inflation and higher rates. But at some point, you will get that tipping point where higher rates and higher inflation expectations start to really undermine the values. The next question came in, it's a similar question, just about interest rates. If interest rates in the U.S. are going up, then the dollar should go up as money comes into the dollar. And what does that mean for gold? What does that mean for the housing market? And it's just not quite that simple that if U.S. interest rates go up, that the dollar goes up. A lot of the dollar's action is determined by it's on a relative basis. What is happening economically? What is happening to GDP growth in other parts of the world? The dollar's activity, the dollar's movements up or down are not just a function of U.S. interest rates. If they were, then this business that we're in would be a lot easier. But as it stands, it's much more complex and nuanced, and we're having to look for individual sectors and companies. And what we do is there's a lot of research that goes into, you know, coming up with investment ideas. We're looking at individual companies from a bottom up. At the same time, we're keeping an overall view, macro view, and our finger on the pulse of the markets to try to find those opportunities. We will look to individual sectors and companies. We'll talk to companies. We'll talk to competitors. We will go through balance sheets. We'll go through income statements. We'll listen to quarterly conference calls. And from those, you can glean a lot of these indicators. So you can focus on those seven different variables that we discussed that will tell you what's going to happen with respect to the economy in a recession. But that alone doesn't necessarily tell you where to invest. A lot of the where to invest decisions come from deep research, looking at companies, who's doing well, who's able to raise prices, who's losing customers, who's taking share. And it's a lot of bottom-up work that Monty, Rudy, and I and the team here do. I don't know if Monty has anything you wanted to add to that. But again, just it's not so simple that if interest rates go up, the dollar's going up, that means gold's going down, housing stocks are going to crash. It's just not that simple because there's so many different nuances to how economies are growing and how the global economy is rapidly changing. New technologies have completely transformed the energy market. And what we expect from energy consumption in the next 5 years, it probably will look completely different than it looks today, and it might even look completely different than it looks in 3 years. It's just there's a lot of disruptive changes taking place. The world is shrinking in terms of the amount of the speed at which things are traveling, new technologies. And there are some are inflationary, some are deflationary. Some cause short-term dollar or currency movements, some don't. Some are very supportive of higher interest rates, but there are still a lot of tendencies and a lot of forces at work out there that are deflationary that could keep interest rates lower for longer. So we're just monitoring all of these things. It's just the relationships aren't so simple. Go ahead, Monty.
Here's a question. With OPEC cutting production and the refineries switching from winter to summer, oil inventory stockpiles reduced, what ceiling price per barrel do you see for oil in 2018? That's a very tough question to answer. We would say 65, 68, with a possibility of 70 at the peak. We think by the end of 2018, the price of oil will be in the 60 to 65 range. We believe the price range this year will rise, will be between 55 and 70 with a year-end closing of about 65. A further add-on question. With rising interest rates, and gold for 2018, how does that impact oil price? Oil price is dependent upon many things. Most important, of course, is what the OPEC decides to do with their production. They've cut their production. They've allowed the U.S. to become the largest producer in the world. This has slightly also been created by the technology that has allowed people to produce oil from fields where it was $150 a barrel to produce. Now with new technology, they can produce oil and make money at $50 a barrel. So this has created much more supply of oil, which has forced the OPEC people to cut their production and in order to keep the price up. OPEC benefits more when the price of oil is 60 if they produce 10% less than if the price of oil is 45 or 50, which it would be if they produce 10% more. So right now, OPEC is saying that they're going to keep production low until the end of 2018. It very much depends on if they stick to that or for political reasons or from pressure from members of OPEC or fighting between members of OPEC, that changes. As long as that remains the same, our forecast remains the same. Any other questions?
Just one question that came in about how to invest in China, and it's an interesting question because they are thinking about it frequently, and not just China, but other countries. One of the things that you can do as a U.S.-based investor, if you are, is you have access to ETFs, which give you broad market exposure, or you can look at some of the individual companies. The individual companies that are listed here, some of them are good, some are not. What we would suggest is focus on the ones that are growing, the ones that are gaining share, the ones that have earnings growth, and maybe avoid the state-owned enterprises, the ones that are controlled by the government, the ones that are large, inefficient bureaucracies. So if you can focus in on companies with good technologies, growing in customer base, growing in earnings, focus there. There are a few. A lot of them are internet related, social media related, internet commerce related companies that we own for clients. The ETFs are great, but again, many of them have large holdings in state-owned enterprises that just are not that attractive. I think we have one more question. I'll pass it to Rudy.
We got a question about what is the best strategy during war or preparing for war, and particularly thinking at the current juncture about North Korea, which even though things seem to have reached a certain level of calm at the moment, it's still lurking there as a big problem. Recent events in Syria between Iranian proxies and Israel also remind us that part of the world is although it's been peaceful, relatively peaceful of late, it's always a potential flashpoint. And our simple answer to this question is that under situations of extreme geopolitical events like that, our preference would simply be to exit the market entirely and be in cash. I don't know if Monty has anything that he wants to add to that.
Yeah, if we got into a major war like World War II or the Korean War or the Vietnam War, this would not be good for the U.S. stock market at all. It would be terrible for the U.S. bond market because interest rates would rise as capital became tight and assets were spent on war preparedness and war mobilization. That is not in the future, in our view. North Korea itself would probably be handled, should they be unwise enough to want to start a war, would probably be relatively short and very bloody and difficult. And that would cause a big crash in U.S. and global stock markets and a big crash in global bond markets. So it's not a time for being invested at all. We think that is very low probability. We've noticed that one of the best performing stock markets in the world over the last 6 months has been the South Korean stock market. Clearly, many global investors do not believe that a war between North Korea and the United States impacting South Korea would take place.
We got a few questions, but I think we will answer those questions offline, or we will incorporate some of those questions in our next commentary. You can also call our office too, and We also provide weekly podcasts. You can also check us out on YouTube and Vimeo, where we do our weekly updates on via video and also on podcasts. For those who would like to listen to this conference call again, there will be a Windows media file available to view in the next few days. If you like the PowerPoint presentation, please email the request to Guild, that's G-U-I-L-D, at guildinvestment.com, and we'll email you the presentation deck. Thank you for participating in our conference call. In addition to offering subscription to our global market commentary, we are a registered investment advisor and offer investment management services. If you are interested in Guild Investment managing your portfolio, please give us a call at 310-826-8600. Also, for those questions that we weren't able to answer due to time constraints, please feel free to give us a call on that number too. You can schedule a complimentary no-obligation portfolio review and financial plan. Please mention your attendance on this conference call in order to participate in this limited-time offer. If you are a current investment management client and you know someone that would benefit from our professional services, please contact our office and we'll gladly reach out to them. Again, you can visit us at www.guildinvestment.com to sign up to get our email updates. We also have a podcast available in the iTunes store, and we also are setting up a YouTube channel where you can see weekly videos that we're producing. So there's several ways that you can get our updates, either by video, by podcast, or by email. We'd like to thank everyone that participated on this call, and we wish you a wonderful Thursday. Thank you.